This podcast is sponsored by El Spelio. You go to elspelio.com, you'll find the best caving light you'll ever own, including the top-of-the-line Lunatic. But if you see the price of the Lunatic and you think, I don't do that much caving, well, then look over at the Grinta 1700. Is that a little more your speed? Or maybe think about how much caving you do. You know what? Don't let me tell you what to do. If you're ready to start investing in your caving life, go to elspelio.com and see what they got for you. How about that? And if anything goes wrong, you know that the rigors of caving can really tear stuff up. They've got support, replacement parts. Doug is right there. He can help you. And he imports the best caving lights in the world. elspelio.com. If you suffer from light envy, as all of us has at one point, then go to elspelio.com and envy no more. And I was just looking. They also sell a waterproof case for your Disto X2. That looks pretty heavy duty. So see what they got, elspelio.com, and I've got a link in the description of this podcast as well. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto, former chairman, and I'm proud of that fact. If you are thinking about getting involved in grotto leadership, you ought to. Well, first of all, what's a grotto? I'm so glad you asked. A grotto is a local chapter of the National Speleological Society. That's our national organization, and what do? Well, we promote caving, cave exploration, or just recreational caving. We seek to control access to caves. And by control, we mean a lot of things. Yeah, we want to be able to go in them, but we also want to be able to protect them and make sure that the only people who are allowed in them are responsible people. That's a good way for caves to get wrecked, is to just let everybody know where it is and how to get in. We believe that caving should be done responsibly. And we know how easy it is for the wrong information to get into the wrong hands. And so that's why, if you're kind of new to this, you might notice that some people are a little secretive. We're not trying to be jerks. We're just trying to protect the resource. But if you're here and you're listening to this, then that means that you're at least kind of interested, right? And if you are, then you need to go about it the right way. Find your local grotto. I'll put a link in the description of this podcast to help you find the local grotto. But you can go to caves.org. That's the NSS website, and you can find it that way. Caves.org. Pretty easy to remember, right? So I did go caving this past month. I almost said one trip. It was two trips, but the second trip was just a few steps into a very, very small cave in McCormick's Creek State Park here in Indiana called Wolf Cave with my 2-year-old, my 3-year-old, and also, or a 2-year-old and 4-year-old, now 5. He turned 5 last week. Jeez. And also my dad, who went farther than any of us into that cave. It was particularly wet that day. The water was running through it, and the kids didn't want to go any further, and dad was like, come on in, and we really didn't we didn't go in any further. We didn't have the right gear. But everybody had fun. But the real caving trip happened on the 1st, May 1st, and I just took a bunch of noobs. One person who had done it before, but everybody else was new to it, relatively new, through Buckner Cave, a cave I've talked about a lot, and a cave which actually Gretchen and I are about to talk about a little bit. And it was a wonderful time, but I got the flu on that trip. Nobody else did. I'm so thankful. But me and my cousin's daughter, who was along on the trip, she's like 13, she gave me the flu. And I drove her all the way back home to near Lafayette, Indiana. And so all of that time in the car together and all that time in the cave, she, you know, at some point during the day, she passed a little influenza A my way, and I was sick for a good week and a half after that. But I'm glad it wasn't COVID. I did not need that in my life. I didn't need the flu either, but and that made the following week kind of interesting because I had two like in-person artist interviews, and so I had to wear a mask for most of it. And because what I do in my day job is I'm on the radio in Indianapolis, which, by the way, I was pretty much done talking about caving. By the way, I wanted to make sure I mention this too. So I host another podcast called WTTS in Conversation. Not that, you know, I know you're here for caving, but if you happen to like me too, subscribe to that one, or I don't know, put it in the list, or maybe just peruse. Again, it's called WTTS in Conversation. That's the radio station I work for. And it's me talking to, you know, rock stars. I talk to Sting. And I talked to Graham Nash and Don McLean and a few other legends and a bunch of emerging artists as well. And I got to tell you, I am very proud of that work, but nobody listens to it. I get the numbers back every month, and more people listen to the Caving Podcast than listen to that thing. And I work really hard on that thing. So I don't know. If you feel like maybe checking that out too, please do that. Again, it's called WTTS in Conversation. And I'd just love to get a few more years on it if I possibly could. Hey, it's June, and so convention is this month, Rapid City, South Dakota. I put a link to the NSS convention website in the description of this podcast if you want to check that out. Also, my home grotto, Central Indiana Grotto. We host Indiana Cave Capers. It's the first weekend of August this year, the 5th through the 7th. I never miss that one. I wish I could say I'm going to convention in South Dakota. I wish I could say that. In fact, earlier this year, I would have told you that I am going, but I'm not. I'm sorry to say. Very sorry to say. My wife's family's going on vacation in Colorado the following week, and I just couldn't get the time. And there's also, I mean, I don't know if you've noticed this where you live, but the concert season is insane. And it's keeping me pretty busy at work with artists coming through town and wanting to be interviewed and wanting to do, we do this series called Sun King Studio 92. Sun King's a brewery here in town. My wife used to work there. And they sponsor this live performance series that we have. And artists come through and they'll play a few songs. I'll talk to them for a little bit. And then we put it up on the website. And we've got a lot of those coming up. And a couple of them, I think, the week of convention. And so I just had to cancel those plans. So maybe next year in West Virginia. But I will be at Indiana Cave Capers. In fact, I might be there that Thursday night, the 4th, if they let me. That one's Friday the 5th through Sunday the 7th at Camp Rivervale. And I'll put up a link to pre-register for that in the description as well. Indiana Cave Capers near Mitchell, Indiana. All right, I've talked a lot. I didn't plan on talking a lot, but I guess I did. I have Gretchen Baker on the show this month. My goodness, how much fun was it to talk to her? She is the current national coordinator for the National Cave Rescue Commission and has been since last year. Previous national coordinator was fellow Hoosier Anmar Mirza. We talked a little bit about him. And I mean, I could go through the list of things that she has done, but we'd be here all day. Let's just get right to it. It is the incredible and wonderful Gretchen Baker on the Caving Podcast. Gretchen Baker, welcome, welcome, welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you, Matt. It's an honor to be here. I've really enjoyed listening to your podcast.
Well, thank you very much. So, man, what a place to start, Jewel Cave.
I feel like it's a little bit of a minor miracle that I even started caving because
isn't it for all of us a little bit?
That's true. I grew up in northern Indiana where it is just flat.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Really?
Yes.
You're a Hoosier? Oh, I man. That's great.
But I didn't know caves when growing up because not all the caves there, in northern Indiana are flooded. They're still in the forming stage. So my parents took us kids out on trips and I got to see Mammoth Cave and some caves in Wisconsin and Minnesota. And then a couple trips to the Black Hills where we got to see Wind and Jewel Cave. And so I had those images in my mind and I liked caves, but they were far away and I had no way to get to them. And then comes college. And my college roommate, my sophomore year, comes to me with some forms in January and says, Gretchen, you should fill this out. This would be great for you. And I look at the forms and they're an application for the National Park Service. And I'm like, huh, I've never even thought about this. And she said, we usually don't put out the forms for summer jobs till March, but these are due at the end of January. So you better just fill it out. And it was bubble form. It dates me a little bit, but we had to fill in all the little bubbles. And at that time, you could only pick two parks that you could apply to work to. And so I picked the Badlands and Jewel Cave out in South Dakota. And lucky for me, Jewel Cave needed a whole bunch of people. And it was fine that I had no experience. And when I got the call for the interview, the supervisor said, we have three different types of cave tours. Our standard tour, where you take people along a lit trail, the historic tour, where you take them with a lantern, and the spelunking tour, where you lead them into a wild part of the cave. And I said, I wanted to lead that spelunking tour, even though I had never done it before in my life. And she never asked. And when I got out there, they trained me and then they let me loose with 10 people and I took them off on the spelunking tour and I was hooked.
So you started as a professional caver.
You never thought of it that way.
your caving career has really been a career.
Well, It was so much fun, though. I knew I wanted to do it more than just leading people. I wanted to have fun and go on exploration trips and recreation trips. And
well, so that just, that had to have made a big impression, like just doing it. I mean, you kind of knew you wanted to, you kind of knew you liked caves. You thought you liked caves, and then you did it. And then somewhere in there was a moment where you realized you really liked it. Can you track that moment?
I don't remember it precisely, but I just remember that I liked being underground. It felt like home. That was where I was meant to be.
Ah, it was a series of moments. Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. So I've always wanted to ask somebody who does this. Okay. So the wild tour is about as close as any normal person. And by normal person, I mean, non-caver comes to caving. I mean, it is really caving. But I've always wondered whether or not or how you dealt with people having a negative reaction in that environment. Did you ever come across that?
Yes, there were several people that freaked out on the tour because the Splunking Tour in Jewel Cave has some really tight spots and some really difficult spots. It's one of the more difficult wild cave tours out there. And so I learned how to talk people through tight spots and how to teach them how to move in micro movements. And those skills really served me well throughout my caving career.
I mean, I guess so. I mean, you're the national coordinator for the NCRC, right?
Yes.
And yeah. So you've kind of got the skill set of calming people down and taking care of that kind of problem. And everybody, I mean, maybe not everybody, but I've certainly run into that kind of situation where you gotta deal with that. You're taking in a first timer and maybe they've got latent claustrophobia and it just doesn't go well. But I would imagine for the national park, and I don't want to stay on this too long because you've got a long list of things that I want to go over, because my gosh, you've done all kinds of things. I would imagine at the national park level, doing something like that, there's some like disclosure type stuff or some waiver type things that people need to sign. There's some legalities going on there, right?
Sure. Everyone had to sign a waiver. And then they also had to do our little test, which was to fit through the concrete block outside the visitor center, which is 8.5 inches high by about a couple feet wide. And it has a removable concrete lid, but I'd always have so much fun standing on the lid as they went through it just to make it seem like it was even tougher. And almost everybody made it through that had signed up for the tour. But once in a while, there was somebody who just couldn't fit. And we're like, sorry, if you can't fit here, you are going to get stuck in the cave. And we really don't want that to happen.
No refunds?
Oh, they got their money back.
Okay, yeah. They got their money back.
Yeah.
And so you've, after that, you kind of went, did you go straight into exploration?
I did some exploration at Jewel Cave out in the past Cloud 9 area. And so that was through the Miseries and Mini Miseries. And that was so fun to be able to incorporate into my tour that I was giving, where I told people about going through a part of the cave where you started off on your hands and knees, and then you got to a part where you went in and you had to decide which way you turned your head. Because once you started in, there was no turning your head the other direction. Oh. It was solo. And that pretty much freaked everybody out. They're like, okay, let's just stay on this walking tour. This is good.
That's one of my favorite. I mean, look, I do it because I love caving, but it is one of my favorite things to do is to tell non-cavers what caving is like and to use those examples, those extreme examples. It's just a lot of fun. All right. So you've been caving outside of the United States as well.
Yeah. So soon after that experience, I got to go on my first international trip down to Mexico. Jim Pizarrowitz from Wind Cave was leading trips there at that time. And Luis Hose was also involved. And that was to study caves near Tapihulapa in the state of Tabasco. And one of our main focuses was on the Cueva de Villa Luz, which is one of the strangest caves I've ever been in. It has sulfuric acid dripping from the ceiling. And so you go in there with these old clothes and it's very warm. So you're just in t-shirt and shorts and you're going in there and there's a stream flowing. And if you get a bunch of sulfuric acid on you, you just get down in the stream and wash it off. But there are these fish that live in this stream in this really toxic environment. And it's just fascinating, and all sorts of cool invertebrates. And then you have to also take air monitors because periodically there will be pulses of bad air and you have to run under a skylight so you can get some good air there. or have little spare air canisters to take with you. So if you get a really bad pulse of bad air, that you can be okay.
Were you in respirators on that trip?
No.
Okay. Because I've seen that. I've seen people do that. Thankfully, I've never had to experience that myself. But man, okay. So that was exploration, though. I mean, did that ever get in your head? Like doing that?
It was amazing being down there. And that just was, I wanted to do more. But school kind of got in the way because I had decided I didn't want to keep guiding tours. I wanted to be in the resource management part of the National Park Service. And I needed to go back to school for that. So I ended up at a graduate school at Indiana University, which opened up my whole world because I was like, wait, there's southern part of Indiana is so cool. Wow.
There's a bunch of caves here.
Yes.
So where, okay. So I got to ask, cause that's, I mean, you know, that part of the state is my caving stomping ground. Where did you go? What did you frequent?
Oh, Buckner, Blair, King Blair, Triple J, Sullivan's. So a lot of the caves you have mentioned over time on the podcast, I've been to quite a few of those. And that's really where I got my start in cave rescue because I met up with Don Paquette, Anmar Mirza, Jim Johnson, and they started teaching me the ropes, literally, of how to do up and down because I didn't have much vertical experience at that time. So I learned that and then got into cave rescue. So I've done Gory Hole on Knots a couple times because I was a poor grad student, had no money for gear. but after a couple times doing Gory Hole on Knots, I was like, yeah, maybe I'll save some money up to get some regular ascenders.
get you some Jumars, make things a little easier on you. So you've done, I'm sure you've done all the vertical classics, and not all of them, but all the big ones like Freeman and Green Eye and things like that in Indiana.
I've done a fair number.
Gory Hole, that is that's one of my favorites. I can't wait till this episode's out in June, so the National Forest caves in Indiana are open from May through August. Yeah, okay, so I got to stay on the Indiana caves for a little bit. Is there a particular trip? So there are a few trips in Indiana that some people have called the what do they call it? They call it the Mount Everest of Indiana caving. There's the Camp 4 trip in Wayne. There's the Rise trip in Sullivan. There are a few others that, you know, people are like, oh, you got to do that one. It's long. It's tough. What were some of those in your memory?
I remember doing the Rise in Sullivan because we camped out the night before in the cave and during the middle.
Where'd you camp in the cave?
Just in the stoop way. So not very far in from there.
Yeah.
From the entrance. But I remember waking up in the middle of the night because somebody had woken up and they yelled, there's a rat. And we couldn't resist yelling, well, is it white? Like it had become cave adapted. It was just silly.
So you did that one. Oh, I love that trip. That's still to this day my favorite cave trip that I've ever taken. It's going back to the Rise.
That was awesome. And then I loved River Cave down in, I forget all the names of the places, but down in the valley that has a whole bunch of water caves down in it. And you can go and canoe for part of it. And I have very good memories of Indiana caves.
And so then that brought you to after Indiana University. Oh, and the starting cave rescue. Okay.
I just did my level one in Indiana. It was a modular and started teaching some OCRs, or orientation to cave rescues. And I really enjoyed it. I was like, this is fun. I enjoyed the people I was around and getting to travel to places like Kentucky to teach some of these classes. And so that kind of stuck with me. And then I went to Carlsbad Caverns to do a season there. And that was fun just being at another cave and seeing the majesty of Carlsbad because it's a fantastic cave.
Yeah. Well, now, and what else is there? did you do Ledge?
So I did. Yep. Oh. So I was doing part of this was I got to do an internship that counted for part of my grad school. And so I volunteered on my weekends for resource management. And I did get to go on a monitoring trip into Lutch out to the Oasis, out the Western Borehole. And that was fantastic.
Wow.
So my vertical skills had improved quite a lot by then. So it was just a lot of fun going through on all the rappels and the traverses and then all the climb outs. It was just fun.
Was that the one and only trip into Lech?
That's been my only trip in there.
You're still a Lech caver. You did it. You did it once. I'd like to be able to do it just once too, one of these days. And then, Great Basin National Park.
So yeah, so then after Carlsbad, I finished up school, and then I actually got jobs in Yellowstone and Everglades, and I had applied to Great Basin National Park and never heard anything. I'm like, oh, they hired somebody else. But then I got a call and they said, hey, would you be willing to come out and work with Bonneville cutthroat trout? And I'd worked with Yellowstone cutthroat trout in Yellowstone National Park. And so I said, sure, even though I had never been out to Great Basin, I didn't know what to expect. And I got out there and worked with the cutthroat trout and found that the park is amazing. It goes from the valley, which is 5,300 feet, up to a peak that's over 13,000 feet. And so it's got all these different habitats. It has a tiny little glacier. It has 40 caves, including Lehman Caves, which is a show cave, and about 33,000 people a year go in there, and it's very well decorated. And so I didn't get to work with all the caves at first, but I was near them. And then my job evolved from a biological science technician into the ecologist. And then I was able to add cave specialist duties. So now I manage about 40 caves here in the park.
Wow. Okay. So, I mean, look, I don't want to make you pick favorites or anything like that, but like, what are some highlights of the caves around there that, that you just can't help but bring up?
Well, as an ecologist, I'm pretty partial to things that are living. And so I get really excited about the cave biota. And there's a tiny pseudoscorpion. So it's called pseudoscorpion because it's a false scorpion because it doesn't have a stinging tail, but it does have the pincers. And it was first discovered in Lehman Caves in the 1930s, but it wasn't described to science until the 1960s because it is hard to find specialists who know what these things are and who can do the adequate work for them. But now we know about this Great Basin cave pseudoscorpion, and we've looked for it in a bunch of other caves, and it's only in caves in this mountain range and not found anywhere else in the world. And I just like, that blows my mind. Yeah. Like, whoa! So there are some other millipede species that are also endemic here. And then one real exciting find, I was in a cave called Model Cave with some coworkers, and one of my coworkers and I had both had recurring nightmares of being in that cave and having water levels rise so fast that we'd be pushed out, kind of like Indiana Jones running away from the rock, that we'd have to be like scurrying down this tunnel, but it's not big enough to run. We'd have to be crawling as fast as we could to avoid this rising water. Well, so on this one trip, we're way back in the cave, and it keeps going down, down, down till you hit the water table. But there's a couple places where you go down and then you go up. And we were surveying past a place where we had gone down and then up. And when we got back to the down part, it was starting to fill in with water. Oh, the no. water table was rising, and we're like, oh, this is sort of like our nightmare coming true. And there was a puddle we had to get around. So one of my coworkers, Ben Roberts, looked down and he's like, there's something moving in this puddle. And I looked down and I was like, oh, sure enough. And so I had some little specimen bottles and I collected a couple and I took them out of the cave and we sent them to Steve Taylor, a great cave biologist. And he's like, go get more. These are a new species to science. And it turned out to be a little amphipod, similar to a freshwater shrimp, that just hangs out in the water table. And so we had to go back multiple times because the pool would go, it would sometimes be flooded, it sometimes would be dry, and it had to be just the right level for us to see these little amphipods. But we were able to collect more, and he was able to describe them and name them. And now we only know them from that one cave, which is just very cool. So wow. Every time we go in that cave, we look for them. Yep.
Okay. So when I think of the Great Basin, I think of, and maybe I'm wrong about this, and I'm hoping you can educate me here. But when I think of the Great Basin, I think of a particularly harsh environment, a lot of salt. So these have got to be specialized organisms. Is the water found in those caves sort of high salinity?
Not particularly high salinity.
Okay.
So one of the things about the Great Basin is it does have the Great Salt Lake up near Salt Lake City, which is super salty.
Yeah.
But when we have the mountain ranges, we have nice fresh water.
Okay.
But there are, in Nevada, the state of Nevada, there are more mountain ranges than any other state in the U.S., over 300. And they're all lined up kind of like caterpillars. So you just go from mountain range to mountain range, and each mountain range has been separated long enough from others that we sometimes have specific species that are only on one mountain range. And you go to the next one and there are different species there. And it seems like the caves have that even more than the surface. Just, it's exciting because there's a whole frontier out here. The Great Basin area covers a huge amount of land. It was the last section of the continental United States to be explored. Because everybody was like, let's go around that. That's too difficult of territory. So now there's still a lot to explore.
Well, okay. So, all right. So that leads me to my next question then. The area is not caved out, right? Like there's still more to find.
So there is still a lot more to find. And I've been going with the Timpanogos Grotto in the West Desert of Utah in the House Range. Matt Paulson is one of the leaders there. And there are trips every few months to go find new caves. And we often find a new cave. It might not be super long. Many of the caves in the Great Basin are, if you get over 100 feet, you're doing really well.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
But there can be some really cool things in there. Even geologically, there's some really neat caves that have things that aren't found in other caves. Or even like hydromagnesite balloons, which are fairly rare in the world.
Yeah.
So it's neat. And also the paleontology is great out here too. There used to be huge lakes. The Great Salt Lake is the remnant of Lake Bonneville, which was as big as Lake Michigan. And when that lake was here, there were bristlecone pines growing much lower down. There were a whole bunch of cool animals like dire wolves, camels, several species of small horses, American cheetahs, lots of pronghorn species, and the biggest bear ever known to the world, the short-faced bear, was out here. And so those bones have been found in different caves in the area. And so it's fun going in these caves going, oh, maybe we'll find another cool species that was here. And we can find some evidence of that.
Well, so what are those timelines? You mentioned the bristlecone pine. Mm-hmm. That one lives a long time. There's no more surviving ones around there, are there?
So the bristlecone pines still live, but they're above 9,000 feet elevation.
Okay.
But they used to grow all the way down to about 6,000 feet.
Really? Different
so
environment.
The climate's really changed. So it's gotten a lot drier and hotter. But back when Lake Bonneville was here, it was a lot cooler and wetter. And so it started drying up quite a bit about 15,000 years ago. So we're not even talking all that long ago.
Geologically speaking, yeah.
Yep.
Okay, so you mentioned that the caves are short. What are the exceptions?
Well, Lehman Caves is the longest cave in the state of Nevada. It's over 2 miles long. We also have some deep caves. So we have several at high elevation that are over 200 feet, and our deepest cave is over 400 feet. And one of the cool things about that is it's got a lot of ice in it. And so that was a whole new experience of learning how to do vertical work with crampons on. Because you're like, ah, these crampons, and you don't want to step on the rope. Really don't want to step on the rope with them.
Oh, no.
So that's, and it's cold. So you can't stop and take long breaks. Like just a 2 minute break is all you get because you start getting pretty cold. So you got to keep moving. And so that's a whole nother environment and just seems so out of place in the Great Basin Desert.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Let me tell you a little bit about lint camps, because that's something special we have at Lehman Caves. And they happen at a variety of different places, but most people are like, what's a lint camp?
Yeah, I had the same question.
So for managing the cave, we have a whole variety of different things going on. But every person who goes into a cave leaves behind a few pieces of lint from their clothes. And we do it without knowing, unintentionally. We also leave behind a little hair, some skin cells. And for most caves, this really doesn't matter. But when you have a lot of people going through the caves, like the show caves, that can build up over time.
Yeah.
And Lehman Caves has been a show cave since 1885. So we're talking well over 100 years of people going through there, each person leaving a little bit of themselves behind unintentionally. And it can lead up to make fuzzy stalactites. The lint is really lightweight and it can go up in the air currents and attach to the speleothems and disrupt their growth. It can provide an unnatural food source in the caves. And we certainly don't want to be feeding the wildlife in the national parks. And it's just unsightly. It makes everything look kind of grayish when it disguises the natural colors of the cave.
Yeah.
And so every winter, when the cave's a little bit drier, we hold a lint camp and we ask volunteers to come and help pick off this lint or brush it off with toothbrushes and little paintbrushes. And it has been wildly successful. We have a really dedicated group of people that come, and then we get a few new people who come because they hear about it on their cave tour and they're like, we want to check this out. And we actually fill up our lint camp so quickly because people are really eager to come and we have a great time doing it. And it's, if you have any OCD impulses, this is the time for them to come out. I'm like, I enjoy cleaning the cave so much more than I enjoy cleaning my house. And you just like start with a patch and you start brushing it off and you get to this beautiful formation underneath and you're like, wow, this looked really nice. And now it does again because I just got the lint off of it. Or you take the lint off the walls. In some places, the lint is so thick because it's just accumulated. You can write the word lint in the lint and see it stand out.
Wow. Okay. I've never heard of this. I mean, I'm out here in Indiana where everything's damp all the time. So that's got to be the difference, right? The fact that your caves are so dry, that's why you see this sort of thing.
It's a lot easier to get the lint off when it's dry. Yeah.
Okay.
There is lint in wet caves, but it is harder to see.
Yeah.
But one of the best ways to find it is take a black light in. And when you take the black light in, you can see all the different colors from the fibers and clothes. And that's where you're like, whoa, okay, there's a lot more lint here than I thought.
What else do you see with a black light in a cave?
Some of the minerals turn different colors, so that's kind of fun.
I never thought to bring a black light into a cave. Man.
Oh, it's really fun. Yeah.
Yeah. So lint camps, man, that is fascinating. I never considered that to be an issue. And you don't have any trouble finding volunteers for this, it seems like.
We don't. And it's our lint camps at Great Basin are a lot of fun because it's a mixture of cavers from grottos and then just general public. And so for the general public to talk to cavers, they're like, oh, wow, there's this whole other world out there. And sometimes we have little parties where we do some furniture caving in the evening and they're just like, whoa, okay, you guys have a different way of having fun.
So you got the survey dream team?
Okay. Yeah. So we are, one of the things I do at the park is write proposals and management plans. So I recently wrote management plans for Lehman Caves and then for all our other wild caves. And after I wrote both of them, I put all the things we had identified in the management plans into proposals to get funded, all our data gaps. And fortunately, they've gotten funded. So for Lehman Caves, we were able to do a virtual cave tour led by Blaise LaSalle, which is amazing. And you can find it on YouTube if you just search for Lehman Caves virtual cave tour. And it takes you through the cave and you see more on that than you do in an actual cave tour. You don't get the whole experience of being cold and being in the cave, but you get to see different things because it's lit up so well. And so that was really cool. And then we're going to be putting in a new lighting system in Lehman and improve some other infrastructure in there. And then for the wild caves proposal, we said, oh, we really like to know what is in every cave in detail. So the biology, the geology, the paleontology, the archaeology. And so this proposal is to hire a dream team with one specialist for each of those areas who will come in and really dig deep into these caves. So do literature research and then go to the caves and go to the caves again, repeat that, because you don't see it all in the first time. And especially with biology, you often have to go multiple times to be able to find what's there. And so we're in the process of hiring that dream team, and those folks will be working on these wild cave surveys on both the park and then the Forest Service. It's that interagency project for over the next year.
Well, let's get specific on the skill sets you're looking for then, because some people listening to this might be interested in that kind of thing.
Sure. So if we're looking for folks that are really good in their field, and we've had a number of applicants that are already that we're like, wow, these are great. And so we're hoping to have them hired and started by June. And we're going to be looking at the geology in the Great Basin. It has a lot to do with the basin and range when that whole the geographic area formed, because if the cave formed after the mountains raised up, then the caves are generally pretty flat. They're at the level of the water table. But if they formed before that, then they might be at the same dip of the rock. And then we also have tectonic caves too, where the rock is just fractured and they're deep caves. The paleontology, knowing about that, the Pleistocene, what happened, is really helpful. And then the archaeology is something that we know a little bit about, but not a whole lot. So that's a whole nother area to really develop a bigger understanding. And then the biology, like I mentioned, there's so many things that were probably still hidden in these caves that we don't even know about yet. So we just got to keep looking. And so these folks also need to be able to be vertical and go to some of the caves are remote and you have to carry heavy backpacks to them and go up and down mountains. And it's going to be kind of like a fun field camp for an extended period. And then they'll write reports about what they find.
Oh, you're going to find a heck of a crew for that. That's so exciting to hear about. It's a big year for Great Basin, right?
That's right. 2022 is the centennial for Lehman Caves when it was designated as a national monument.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. So President Harding in 1922 made Lehman Caves National Monument, and then that was absorbed into Great Basin National Park in 1986. But we want to really acknowledge that designation. And so we're having a whole bunch of different events this year. And August 6th is actually our big day where we're going to have a whole lot of events. And we invite people to come on out or check out the Great Basin National Park website. And there are a number of things that people can attend virtually.
So if you're out west, think about that. If you're out east, think about going to Indiana Cave Capers that weekend. It's the same week. Very cool. All right. Can we talk about NCRC a little more?
Absolutely.
You are the national coordinator?
That's right.
Okay. So you work closely then with Anmar and the crew?
So Anmar was the previous national coordinator.
Oh, so okay.
I have taken over from him. And it's this position I never expected that I would have. When I started doing cave rescue with Anmar and others in Indiana, I was the farthest thing from my mind. I managed to go to level 2 in West Virginia and level 3 in New Mexico. And so level 1 is where you learn how to be a team member. Level 2, you're a team leader. And so you start leading small teams into the caves. So you might be the comms team leader or the search team leader or the evac team leader. And then level 3 is where you learn some more specialty skills for rigging and a little bit more of the overall structure of a cave rescue. I have to say, I wasn't very good at my level 3. I didn't have a lot of opportunities to practice some of the rigging stuff.
There's a lot there, isn't there? There's just a
there
lot.
Is. Yeah. And when it's new, it's just like overwhelming. And
you got to have the right brain for that kind of thing, too. You really do.
That helps. You know, learning how to be calm in situations where they're high stress is certainly something that helps a lot. And then over time, I've learned too, just to break it down, and repetition helps a huge amount. And so I just got to keep practicing and practicing. And part of the reason I don't think I did that great at level 3, because I didn't have many opportunities to practice before the class. And I got there and I'm like, oh, wow, there's so much I need to learn. And I was like, I can either decide to just give it up here, or I can say, hey, I don't know this. I need to get better. And that's the route I went. And I said, hey, I'm going to work my butt off and keep getting better at cave rescue and not be discouraged that I am not meeting up to my own expectations. And so I kept teaching at OCRs and other regional classes, and teaching really helped me learn it, because if you have to teach it, you have to learn it well enough to explain it. And then I applied for an instructor qualification class and they let me in. So that was great. And learned more in that. And there were wonderful people in my class that I still keep in close contact with. Mel Edie Pumplin is now the training coordinator for the NCRC. Tony Smith is the Eastern Regional Coordinator for the NCRC. Berta Walker is amazing with her rope skills, and she's still an NCRC instructor. Jansen Cardi's up in Alaska doing his stuff. So we had such a good class for my IQ class. And so they let me be an instructor, and I just started teaching even more. And I found that teaching NCRC opened the doors to go to some places I might not otherwise be able to go.
Oh man. Like where?
So Puerto Rico is one. That was a really fun experience going down into such a warm climate to go train there in the caves with all the water and the bats. And that was fascinating to be down there.
And you're like deep in the interior, right? Of Puerto Rico. That's where a lot of the caves are.
Yes. Yeah. A couple hours drive from where we flew in.
Okay.
I've also gotten to go. So not kind of an opposite from that is going to Canada and
yeah.
teaching up there. And that was fascinating too. We did a small party assisted rescue class up there. And in Canada, they tend to have more similar vertical gear. Whereas in the US, people come in with all sorts of different things. You almost never find two people with the same cow's tails, for example. Mm-hmm. But in Canada, they were very similar in how they set up their gear. And that actually made it much easier to teach them because it was like, oh, okay, we can go through some of these steps a lot faster.
Yeah.
So that was cool. I should mention Mentone, which is where we regularly have NCRC classes down in TAG. And there was one year, I was still fairly new to NCRC, and I was assigned to be an angel for one of the patients. So I was going to watch him and make sure everything was okay. And so it was Tom Evans, and we went down this drop, and we were supposed to hang out near the bottom of the drop. And I was like, hey, Tom, I don't think they're going to come find you for a long time, because I had been an angel for other folks and it had been sometimes hours and hours before they were able to find. I'm like, we have time to do a little caving. Let's go check out what's down this passageway.
Oh, great.
So we went down the passageway and then it kept splitting. And then we realized we were lost.
Oh no, you became an actual patient.
And so we're like, well, this is the best time to be an actual patient, because then we can have the team come find us. They're supposed to search anyway.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Well, we actually eventually found our way back to about where he was supposed to be, but they were calling down and ready to come down the drop at that point. And so they were so fast to come into the cave. We're like, oh, good thing we were able to scurry back to this spot.
Wow. So nick of time.
That was fun. But then he got caught up in the Highline debacle, which is where the level three who can do the more advanced rigging were like, let's do a Highline out of Petty John's cave. And level one was like, well, we've spent all week practicing carrying people out. We can get them out really quickly. And the way it went is that they did do the Highline, but it took hours. And so it was a good learning experience for everyone that sometimes simple is better.
I guess so. Wait, you got caught up in a flood in Colorado too?
That's right. So we were doing the mock rescue in Colorado, and it was near the end of the day, and we could see these band of clouds coming in. And I remember John Punches asking me to go up onto the ridge and go check it out and look. And so I went up there and I'm like, we got to call this. This is just, it's coming in fast.
Yeah.
And so we scurried everybody out there, and we decided the quickest route was not the route we had come in, which was where our vehicles were, but instead we were going to go down the canyon. So we all were going down the canyon. The rain started pouring down. It started flooding near us. And when we got down to where there was pavement and town and people, I remember we were like all huddling up trying to figure out how we were going to get in vehicles and go somewhere. And fortunately, there had been people who were on the other side of the canyon doing the incident command system, and they'd been able to get up to some of the vehicles. And somehow we were able to get some vehicles to come for us. And while we were waiting, I noticed there was a pizza shop that was about to close down because of all this flooding. They're like, we're done. Nobody's coming out of their houses. I'm like, food. We got to have some food for people. And so I went in, and somehow I had some money in my cave pack. And I'm like, can I buy you out? And they're like, yes, just we're done for the night. Here's a discount.
Perfect.
So I bought up like all their pizza. And like, we were able to like have our little group was able to eat a bunch of pizza, which held us over until we were able to get to the next set of plans. But it was like, it really reinforced like, yeah, taking care of logistics, even in the, when things are going crazy, is what's important.
You're involved in the curriculum for SPAR. And remind us what SPAR stands for.
Sure. SPAR is the Small Party Assisted Rescue.
Okay, yeah. That's a skill set that is important for every caver to know.
It is. And especially in places, if you're going on really long cave trips where it's not going to be easy to send somebody out to the entrance, or if you're caving a lot in areas like where I am in the Great Basin, where your next cave rescuer might be an hour or two away, you have to be able to have some of your own skills. And so this is a class that NCRC offers now, and it is so much fun. It's a lot of fun to take and to teach, because we have some skill sets where you're just like learning how to do really cool things on rope using the equipment you have. So you don't have to bring in extra stuff. You might want to have a pulley or two with you, small ones with you, and when you go in the cave, but then you learn how to use those and just the rope you have there. And it's almost seems like magic, because you're like, whoa, I didn't know that I could do a whole rescue with this small amount of gear. And so my whole mindset on rescue has really changed, where I'm like, okay, I'm going to learn my gear backwards and forwards so I know each way I can use it. And that way, if something bad happens, I have options.
It's good to know that that is developed as a curriculum, but you kind of helped develop the actual curriculum. What decisions went into, all right, here's a scenario, that's what you got to do. Here's a different scenario, that's what you got to do.
And a lot of it was some trial and error teaching various classes. So Andy Armstrong, Carl Amundsen, Tom Evans were all instrumental in developing this. And we actually were building off an earlier self-rescue class that Becky Jones had started quite a few years ago. And so it's one of those things where it keeps building, and we keep trying to improve it and figure out what are the things that are most useful? What are the things that people are going to remember? What are the things that are safe if you don't practice them for a few months at a time? Because there are some really cool skills out there, say pickoffs, but you need to practice them every month in order to be really proficient at them.
Have you ever had to use these?
So I have had to use some spar techniques. One of them was the biologist from the Nevada Department of Wildlife and I took a paleontologist into a cave to look at some bones in central Nevada. And he had a little bit of experience with rappelling, and he actually went to a climbing gym to have somebody teach him how to frog. And the instructor was sent all these instructions on how to frog, but he taught the guy how to do more of a Yosemite type climbing system, where he had ascenders on two different ropes. And it was sort of it was kind of a mess. And he was against a wall. He didn't know how to free climb at all. So when we got to this cave, we didn't know that whole story. Because he came, he's like, I've practiced, I can climb rope. And we're like, okay. So we got him into the pit. And usually I don't go vertical caving with somebody until I've seen them do a changeover, because I'm like, oh, I don't want to have to rescue you.
Right.
let's just, yeah, we'll avoid that rescue part right from the beginning, because I know that what your skills are and we'll be good. But we didn't have the opportunity to do that. And so we go down in the cave, and he was amazing identifying all these bones and finding that, like, oh, there aren't bighorn sheep on this mountain now, but these bones are here from, and he was able to actually kind of figure out a date. And so just a few hundred years ago, they were here. And so that was really fascinating. But then it came time to go up. And so the endow biologist, Jason Williams, went up, and then the paleontologist started up, and he got about 10 or 15 feet off the floor using his system. And he's like, I'm exhausted. I can't go any farther. This isn't quite what I trained for. And Jason had rigged it with contingency rigging at the top. So he had put in a munter and tied it off. And we didn't have a lot of extra rope, but we had enough to get him down to the floor. And so he was just lowered gently to the floor. And then I thought about giving him my frog system, but I was like, you know what? He's already exhausted. We're just going to do a traveling haul. And so we hooked him up with a traveling haul. And he was able to push up the ascender, and then I would haul him. And we kept doing that. So he'd push up the ascender, I'd haul him. We just keep resetting until he got high enough where Jason was able to lower some webbing down to that upper ascender and pull it way up. And then I was just able to haul, haul, haul. And yep, there he went up. And that was the beauty of like these small party assisted rescue techniques, is you hardly need any people to make it work. You can just, like, I was a one person haul team, and I was able to put it in my crawl and just go down this little hill, and my body weight was enough to get him up.
Man. Yeah. Cause I've been in cave before. I took, and I've only done what I've done. I did the weekend thing. The, what do you call it? Yeah. OCR. I did that. That's all I've done. But
just doing that, you know, made me a better caver. I highly recommend that. I feel a little hypocritical recommending spar because I've not done it, but my goodness, like what a thing to know. Because I've been in caves thinking, man, if something goes wrong, you know, I'm glad I'm with this guy who knows this, or I'm glad I'm with this woman who knows this. But if I'm the leader, I'll just do the thing where I leave somebody with them and run out. And then what do I do? And what do I know? Because when I first heard about the SPAR curriculum, I thought, well, that's a good idea. That's a really, really good thing to focus on, as opposed to all of this sort of highly technical stuff that NCRC tends to talk about. To apply it then to a smaller party, you know, sort of maximizing the efficiency and the resources available in that smaller party, which is more often than not what you're caving with anyway. Just really, really terrific idea. Now, I would imagine you've been on some actual cave rescues before.
Yeah, smaller ones. We don't tend to have the huge ones that happen in places like out east and in Tag. Mainly because our caves are smaller here, but there is some potential for that in eastern Utah. There's some caves that are over 10 miles long. And a few years ago, there was a big call out rescue, and I was on my way there, and I didn't get there in time because it was a long drive. But yeah, that was there. And then we have occasional rescues out of Lehman caves where people are getting sick or they have a knee that gives out and we have to go in and get them out. While I was at Carlsbad, we had to roll some people out of the cave too on our wheeled litters. And so, yeah, just smaller things for call outs for me.
So then when things happen, you being the national coordinator, where are you on the call list? I mean, I don't know. What have you had to coordinate where that's concerned?
So most of the coordinating we do for National Cave Rescue Commission, it happens ahead of time. So we are trying to get people trained up. We are trying to build gear caches throughout the country. So if people need specialized gear, we can get it to them pretty quickly. And then we have a database of people who have gone through the training. So if the agency having jurisdiction and running the rescue needs some additional cave resources, we're able to provide them. So we have 10 regional coordinators for different areas of the country, and each regional coordinator is able to get their folks if they're requested and say, hey, we have this call out happening. Are you available to respond? And then if they are, they go there and they are like either deputized or volunteer for whoever's running their cave rescue, or there's a prior agreement that they can participate, and then they're able to help out that way. So we kind of have that three prong, like we were really focused on training our gear caches and having a database of who can help. Those are main things for the NCRC. Like I mentioned before, I'd never expected to become national coordinator, but I was convinced to run for education committee. And one of the cool things about NCRC is that we are always refining our curriculum. And so once a month, there's a meeting and we keep working on making it better and using the latest techniques and incorporating those. So I spent time on that. And then the Western Region Coordinator position became open. And so I took that and started trying to build more relationships with different counties, and sheriff's offices out here typically run the cave rescue. So working with them. And then the national coordinator position came open, and I decided to run for that. And one of the things I wanted to do was try to make NCRC more transparent and to improve communications, both within our organization, with our parent organization, the NSS, and with other groups, because I didn't realize that it was so intricate in the workings of the NCRC until I got into these positions. I was like, wow, this such an impressive organization. And so many people have made it so. And so I feel like I'm just kind of stepping on their shoulders, trying to make it bigger. But we have ways now, new technology for communicating, such as we can do Zooms or other kind of meetings online so easily. And so now we're trying to do a couple instructor meetings a year on Zoom. So even if people can't come to the national seminar, we can still connect and find out what's going on and what the latest things are. And then NCRC is also a part of some bigger organizations. So ICAR is one, which is the International Commission on Alpine Rescue, and they have a cave subsection. And so we are a member of that and help provide information on what we're doing. And then we absorb information of what other teams are doing in other parts of the world. And then the European Cave Rescue Association. We also have a lot of folks attend the EITRS International Technical Rescue Symposium that the NSS helps sponsor in the fall. And so there's ways that we're trying to make NCRC more known and more connected in the whole world, because it's such a good organization.
Well, and that benefits not just because there are then more people who know about it, but then more people who then know who to call, I guess.
Right. And so we're trying to, yeah, get the word out, like, okay, make sure you have a surface contact before you go in the cave. If there's only one thing you do as far as doing some preparing for a cave trip, make sure you have a surface contact, because if we don't know where you are, that's going to make it really hard to do a cave rescue. So we have a little form that you can get off the NSS page or the NCRC page that you can put in your phone, and then you just fill it out and send it to your surface contact. And so then they can answer questions. If they do have to call 911, they'll have all the information right there. And so that's a huge thing to just prepare in advance.
Do you mind if I ask about Thailand? Did you ever have to do any press when that was happening?
No, when that was happening, I was on the education committee. So sure. I was in no other leadership role.
Okay. Because Anmar did a lot.
He certainly did.
At around that time. I heard him on the radio. I saw him on TV. He was after a lot. So I'm curious how the NCRC sort of, what do you call it when you meet after a rescue?
A debrief.
A debrief. Okay. So a debrief. Mm-hmm. I've heard other terms mm-hmm. as well. So mm-hmm. was there a debrief within the NCRC, even though they weren't involved at all? Was there a debrief? Did you talk to some of the British cavers who were involved, some of the people who were involved, to sort of trade information after that happened? Are there new protocols that have developed since then that you then incorporated into the curriculum? Since that happened, what's changed?
The main thing that's changed for the NCRC since the Thai cave rescue is understanding how important it is to have a good face for the public and making sure that we are able to give interviews and talk to the press and learning what are the key points and how we do that. They used typical techniques as far as ropes go once they got the boys out to the air passage. The cave diving part was a totally, totally amazing way that they were able to do that rescue. And we do include diving within NCRC. We have a diving officer who covers those areas. But generally, we don't, there aren't a lot of diving cave rescues. It's a lot more recoveries in the diving part of cave diving.
Of course. Yeah. And just an incredible story, obviously.
Yes.
And if you haven't seen the National Geographic film, really, really incredible as well. Okay, let's get into some more stuff. So you got a couple kids. Are they cavers?
So my kids can cave really well, but they would not consider themselves cavers. They're too cool for it right now. They're ages 12 and 14.
Okay. When did they start caving? Because I got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, so we're 10 years away from that stage. And as we're talking right now, I'm hoping to take them to a very small cave in the next couple of weeks.
So they started caving before they were even born. I was just like, oh, I'm just going to cave until it's too uncomfortable. And so, I could do vertical and belly crawls till about halfway through. And then, regular hands and knees crawling till a few weeks before giving birth. But then I wore my kids a lot. And so they came into caves with me just in their front carrier. And
they
got exposed pretty early. But what I find is that kids are natural climbers and they are actually, they've got really good balance generally. There's a couple awkward phases, but overall, if you can trust your kids to do a lot, and if you don't, you put them in a harness, you can just do a webbing harness even for them, because it can be hard to find something that fits them till they get a little bit older. And you just belay them up anything that you're like, oh, this could be tricky, I don't want them to fall. But the kids do awesome. And if it's the more challenging, the better they do. So I'm all for taking kids caving. You got to teach them, of course, to be gentle to the cave, but they generally do really well physically.
Okay. You wrote a mystery novel? I've read the Nevada Bar book that takes place in Lechuguilla, but I haven't heard of this one. I want to read
it. So in 2016, I self-published a book called An Unconventional Murder that's set at the 2016 NSS convention in Ely, Nevada. Ah. And so it was a lot of fun to write. And it's definitely a work of fiction, but I had to put in lots of cave elements in there and speak cave language. And I've had a lot of people tell me, like, the opening scene where I talk about some tight passages have freaked out some people who aren't cavers. They're like, oh, that was so tight. I'm like, that wasn't meant to be that bad. So,
do you sell that online?
Yes, it's available on Amazon.
Okay. All right. I'll put a link in the description of this podcast. If you want to check it out, pick it up. So what is this about the Cave Animal of the Year program?
So within the NSS Cave Conservation Program, we decided to follow along with some other countries that highlight a different cave animal of the year each year. And so we're in our third year in the United States, and we are, this year for 2022, we're highlighting the little brown bat. It's a bat that is found throughout most of the U.S. and Canada, and it is just a cool animal. Bats eat so much of their weight and insects every night that it really is helpful. And we're just trying to let folks know that cave animals go to caves because that's their home. We're visitors. And so when we go to their home, we need to treat it with as much respect as we would if we were going to another human's home and be very nice to their home. And so we're just trying to teach that and increase awareness about what lives underground.
Let's talk about this cave in Mexico that is, there's a railroad going through something, or they're wanting to put a railroad through and it might threaten the area.
Sure. So I got to go do some Mexico caving with Peter Sprouse in the Quintana Roo area, which is just south of Cancun.
Yeah.
And there are so many caves there. It is just a huge network of caves. And there are caves that are places you, when you get out to want to go to the new caves, you go underground through the caves because it's easier than going through the jungle above the caves.
Oh my goodness. And wow.
Just this amazing network. And the Maya people there have this close contact with the caves. It's really a part of their identity. And so there are a lot of artifacts found. There's also one of the things to know about the caves in Quintana Roo is a lot of times there's not much cave roof. So it's a very thin area from the top of the cave to the surface. And there is now a railroad proposal to get more tourists into the area. And some of the places where they want to put that railroad are right over known caves. And we're like, whoa, this may not even support the railroad because it's heavy and that's such a thin roof there that could collapse it, not to mention all the other effects it could have on the caves there. So it's a worrisome proposal.
Well, and it's not just to protect the caves, it's also to protect this potential human history that exists down there. Like I just watched, there's a great series on Disney Plus, the National Geographic portion of Disney Plus called Lost Cities of the Maya. There's an episode that I just watched last night on some of the caves and some of the artifacts that they've found there. It's good to know that people care about this sort of thing, but to destroy some of that knowledge in the process, or potential knowledge in the process, not good. So are you then involved with activism on that front at all?
So Peter Sprouse is one of the people who is helping to inform folks of what's going on. And so I'd say if folks want to learn more, he would be a good person to get in contact with.
Okay. Oh, and I've talked about, you can call them a few different things, steam caves, glacier caves, fumarole caves. Are these all the same thing? You've been to Mount Rainier.
Right. So one year I was helping to be a Sherpa or porter for an expedition that was going up to Mount Rainier to map the fumarole caves at the top of Mount Rainier.
Yeah.
And so that was a totally different experience.
That's a whole different thing, right?
That was the same year I did some of the Mexico caving. I went from the nice, warm, hot climate of near the Yucatan. And then I was like, okay, I got to keep training because I'm going to be going up Mount Rainier, which is over 14,000 feet. And you go up and it's 2 days to get to the top of it. And you spend your night camping on the glacier and hearing it creak and groan as it's moving. And then you get up and you have your packs and you have your crampons on and you have your ice axe and you're going up all this ice, tons of ice to get up to the top. And then you get up there and you go, whoa, there's this crater and there are holes that you can go down into. And Eddie Cartaya organized this expedition and he's like, do you want to go see the lake? And I'm like, of course I want to go see the lake. And so he led some of us in our group down into this fumarole cave. And so fumaroles have this stinky sulfuric gas coming up and it's hot. So you're under the ice and it's hot under the ice. So it's dripping on you really fast. And in some places that water accumulates to make underground lakes. In fact, the one in Mount Rainier might be the highest one in North America. I'm not sure, but it was just crazy. Like see this lake and it was quite trippy to be up there and see all this stuff that is happening. And it's changing pretty rapidly, they're finding. Like there's when you have fumarole come up, the gases warm in some places more than others, combined with climate change, means it's a really dynamic system.
So I spoke with Christian Stenner from Canada, and he had done the same thing. He'd been caving in Mount Rainier. And of course, there's the story that he shared on the podcast, and I think he also shared it with National Geographic about falling into a CO2 lake. Is that a common hazard in that kind of environment, or was this specific to his experience? Is that a sort of thing that you kind of have to anticipate when you are signing on to something like that?
In some parts, there are a higher potential for bad air than others.
Yeah.
So some parts just tend to have better air than others. So you do have to be aware of it the whole time. And yeah, we had a monitor with us, so we knew what we were getting into.
Right. Because when I think of like volcanic gases, I think, yeah, there's got to be some bad air issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are Toastmasters?
So Toastmasters is a group about speaking, and it's to improve your speaking and leadership skills. And Bonnie Armstrong is the one who got me into it. So she's a fantastic caver from Utah, and I was coming back from a caving trip and stayed the night at her house. And she was like, hey, I have a Toastmasters meeting in the morning. Do you want to join in? And I was like, oh, sure. And so at that time, everything was virtual because of COVID. And I attended the meeting. I'm like, this is cool. I'd like to learn how to speak. They had three speakers give prepared speeches. And then they did what they called table topics, which are really quick speeches that are impromptu. And then evaluations of the prepared speeches. And I was like, whoa, this is so much to absorb and learn, but this would be cool to do. And so I joined her club, even though I'm a few hours away, being virtual, it works out. And I have learned how to do better speeches. And I have to say, most of my speeches have been about caves.
Well, so why not?
Yeah. So it's been fun to share the cave world through Toastmasters. But if anyone wants to improve their speaking or leadership skills, and I also joined Toastmasters because it gave me more confidence to run for national coordinator for NCRC. And I've gotten a lot of great skills out of it. So I highly recommend joining Toastmasters. And you can just join for 6 months at a time. And then if your schedule changes, you can join somewhere else. Because there are clubs all over the world. And you just look them up and you can find them on the internet and see what's near you. And it's been a fantastic journey through Toastmasters.
Gretchen, I can't believe how quickly the time has flown by. Just in talking to you, I can just tell that you are a tremendous ambassador for caving. Just your enthusiasm is infectious. Your knowledge is deep. So I don't know. What's the word? If you evangelize caving to someone, what do you say? Why is caving so much fun?
I love going caving because it makes me feel like a kid. And when I'm a kid, I have a sense of discovery, a sense of wonder. And I think that's important for all of us. We can feel young when we go caving. And it's a sport we can do for a long time.
Yeah.
I look at so many people who are older than me who are still caving so well. And I'm like, I want to be like them as I grow up.
Yeah.
And so that just makes me love caving and just finding these new species and these new geologic features and these new things that have been saved by the caves because it's like basically a nice climate in there. I just am like, oh, I want to just keep doing this. This is an awesome hobby and career, and I feel lucky that I've been able to spend so much of my time underground.
Absolutely. Before we wrap things up, you've been to Belize.
Yes. So that was a fantastic trip with the Southern California Grotto and Desert Dogs Grotto and Brian Peace from Vermont. And the Belize trip we're working, or the Belize cave we're working on, is called Panty Pit, which is a multi-level drop to get down to it, about 300 feet of some reblays. And it's very muddy to go down this.
Oh, man.
But warm. Warm, very warm. But it's a little daunting because right next to the pit that we go down, there's an outhouse in the person's front yard. And you're like, oh, okay. How much of that is infiltrating over? We're like, keep your mouth shut as you go down all this. But when you get down to the bottom of that series of rappels, you are in big, beautiful borehole. And we go down the borehole, beautiful formations. And then the cave dips down and gets into a high CO2 area. And so we kind of go fast through that because we don't want to have to stop and breathe any extra of the bad air than we have to. And then we pop back up again and we are in nice passage. And we get to a spot where there's an ear dipper to go through. And so you're kind of making your way through there and trying not to make waves because then you're going to be drinking this water. And pop up on the other side and there's more borehole. And that's where we don't know what is beyond there. And so that's where we're going to be going back.
Are you going back?
And yes, and find out more what's in that cave system. So it's a really exciting experience to have major cave there.
What a perfect segue to my next question. So what's coming? I mean, other than Belize.
I'm also signed up to go to Hungary to take a cave rescue class there. We have a program where we have an international exchange for NCRC instructors. So some of the Hungarian instructors will come to our classes and then we can send two instructors there. So I'm going to head there with Renee Ohms and I'm very excited for that. And then convention in South Dakota and we have our national seminar in Virginia in July and then lots of great basin caving.
Oh my goodness. Okay. How did the time go by so fast?
I know. I kept looking. I'm like, whoa, that did go fast.
Gretchen, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your service to the NCRC. What an exciting caving life. And you're going to do some great stuff. I mean, just this coming year alone and how exciting. Thank you so much for your time. And I appreciate it.
Thank you, Matt. It's been a joy to be on this show with you. And I thank you for doing the podcast.
Oh, man. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Yeah, and have fun with your kids and caving. Like it gets easier.
All right.
And the other thing is if you can go with other kids, that makes a huge impression because they're really like, oh, those kids did it. I'm going to do it.
See them doing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, Gretchen.
Bye.
Oh, Gretchen, that was so great. What a joy. And what an ambassador too. I mean, she spent a good part of her career being an ambassador to wild places. So it only makes sense. She is definitely the one to be doing all of the things that she is doing for caving. And thank you, Gretchen, for that. And thank you for listening. I don't have plans for next month. I don't know who July is, but I got to get on that. I've got a lot of suggestions that have come through the inbox, and thank you for that. If you have your own, you can send it to alpineproductions@gmail.com. alpineproductions@gmail.com. I believe that email address is in the NSS directory as well. I don't know if my current home address is correct. I need to get in there and change that. I've been here for 4 years, and I think they've still got my old one up there. That's not their fault. It's mine. So July is going to be a surprise. When July 1st hits, that name you see will have been interviewed within the last month. I don't have that in the can yet. Thanks to our sponsors, past and present. Of course, El Spelio. Visit elspelio.com. There's a link in the description of this podcast. Get the best caving lights on the planet. Also, Swago. Get that shiny new Swago pack. Perfect for wet caving at swagogear.com. Organic Robot Designs in Greenfield, Indiana. A local t-shirt shop, but he'll make some for your grotto if he's got time. Organicrobotdesigns.com. And I believe he's still got the Etsy store up. All right, is that everything? I think that's everything. Am I going caving this month? Boy, I wish. But I think I'm going to try to do a trip on my birthday weekend. My birthday's July 9th. And I'm still trying to figure out what I'm going to do for that. I might be able to come down to tag. I don't know. Anybody want to do anything? All right. Until then, I'm Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.